Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. This is really, we have a lot of people here, so I'm not sure what's going on. This is our 100th episode of the OIG Roundtable, 100 consecutive episodes for a podcast in which I thought we would last about five episodes, considering that I didn't think that there was enough to talk about every week, but apparently there's enough to talk about. So we're here for our 100th episode. Of course, I've got my normal folks and then some others. It's good to see Jason back for today. Jason has come out of a temporary semi-retirement from one of his 37 trips around the world for today's podcast. Of course, I have Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and now our director of payment integrity here, oversees all of our SIU operations. And Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge and one of the directors on our SIU team and one of our subject matter experts. Of course, Jason, who's retired executive from HHS OIG, the retired Western UPIC director, and our special director in charge. And I'm not quite sure why, but Dan Leslie, our national sales director, director of business development, is here for an OIG roundtable. I'm not sure. He's never worked for the OIG. I don't know if he's ever sat at a round table. I don't know if he knows that. And then, of course, the biggest thing that terrifies me is when Jean Marie, CEO of Advise, pops in for something. There's always some shenanigans. So welcome to this week's episode. It's our 100th episode of the OIG Roundtable. I think we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about a lot of things. So Jean Marie, what do you have in store for us?
Eric, did you not prepare a topic for today?
I have a topic, but I think it's irrelevant for...
Good, okay. Put yourself on mute. That's enough for you talking, because I feel like everybody always feels like, oh God, Eric won't shut up, as usual. But I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you know. I'm going to share my screen. I have a little video for you guys. I'm not sure how the audio will work. Eric, do you know who this is?
Yeah, this would be Joseph Mack, former assistant special, or assistant U.S. attorney.
Okay, let's see how this works.
But to get to the audio, you got to make sure you've enabled audio to be shared on the computer.
Okay, we'll see. What do you think?
Exactly as I suspected. You might want to stop that.
Eric Consortia, of course, will like splice this together for us.
Hey everybody, my name is Joe Mack. I'm a former AUSA here in the District of New Jersey, and it was during that time that I got to work with Eric Rubenstein on many of my most sophisticated cases. During the time that I worked with Eric, he gave me this nifty hat and this cup that I'm drinking from right now. Good stuff. So I hear that you guys are celebrating your 100th episode, and I wanted to tell you guys, congratulations. This is a major, major achievement. Did you know that Gilligan's Island only ran for 98 episodes? So by that measure, you guys are more popular than Gilligan's Island. However, you're not more popular than Dukes of Hazzard, which ran for 147 episodes. So I hope that you, when you get to your 150th episode, that I can congratulate you again, put on this hat, drink it in this cup, and tell you again, congratulations. It's an awesome achievement, fellas. All the best.
Continuing on with the programming, I'm glad that that first thing really worked out well for us. and I love how Eric was just like, not working. I mean, welcome to my house. I will tell you this also. I have an OIG cup today for this 100th episode. I think none of us really thought that this would go weekly other than me and maybe Kia. Dan Leslie felt like it would. So, Dan, thank you for always... being excited to work with us on that. Dan, you interface a lot with our clients, commercial side, you do all the payer stuff. Can you tell us, just in general, like quickly, and I love that I didn't even prepare you on this, but can you tell us like what you think when you think about the OIG guys and what they have to bring to our clients and their knowledge, what they've done around here for Advise?
Absolutely, I hear it every day. There's expertise. Subject matter expertise that just doesn't exist anywhere else, from fundamental investigation expertise to the kinds of training that we offer, we hear it all day long. This is a special group of guys.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much. I will tell you, I feel like this is a really good occasion for us because I listen every week and I like the topics that you guys present. So thank you very much, Wade, Jason, Matt, Eric. Thank you for presenting topics that are relevant to what's going on in healthcare, fraud, waste, abuse. Thank you for bringing your knowledge and your experience. I often go out and talk to clients about how our people who are retired from the government come here and then learn how things are done on the insurance company side. And it's very interesting to make that jump of, for me at least, to see of like, okay, wait a second. It's not necessarily about making referrals or about just the straight up fraud, but more about like waste and abuse and how we do. So I think this podcast has been interesting to see the evolution. I have heard from some people saying to me, oh, well, people who listen to this podcast are mainly guppies. And I said, that's interesting because I hear from our clients that it's more than that. So I've gotten a lot of good feedback about it. I know that some of you, OIG Roundtable guys, some of you at the conferences have had people come up to you and tell you about the podcast. Can you share anything about that? I think Jason got some feedback, maybe Eric.
I guess I was caught off guard and surprised, and I would say I like to think I'm not generally either one of those two things, but when we were at the NAMPI conference a year ago, a gentleman approached me to say how much he appreciated the information that we're sharing, and I think it was basically the candor of how we share it, you know, which just really laying out there, and I was surprised. So it's great.
We will come back to that, but for now, we have our first guest that was just joining us. I saw it pop up. I say our first guest because now I'm letting the cat out of the bag a little bit. We're going to have a few guests, Eric. Hold all of your excitement and your surprise. I saw her pop up, but I'll give it another second. Jason, thank you for sharing that. That to me like shocks me. Like I just can't believe that we have people from different parts of the parts of our industry come up. Oh, here she is. Christina, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Let me get my camera on.
This is just going to be a fun day for everybody. I didn't even tell the guys what was happening this morning. I said, did you prepare a topic? Christina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I would love for you to say anything you want about these guys that you're looking at because you know all of them. I'd love for you to say anything you want about them, the podcast, anything. Just thank you. This is a day of celebrating them.
It is a day of celebrating them. And I don't know if you want me to say anything that I can think of about these gentlemen. Because we need to probably keep it kosher. But I was thinking about you guys. I've been thinking about you guys for the past really several weeks, ever since I knew that this was going to be on my calendar. And it was timely because earlier this week, my son, who is 4, he's in preschool, right? And they've got this whole, you can't even see my advised t-shirt there. Here, let's make this a little bit better. he's learning all about community helpers, right? So the police and the firefighters and everybody. And so Monday night, we were out for dinner with some friends and he's like, my mom is a community helper. And I was like, no, nobody. I'm not. And he was like, yeah, because every day you go into the basement and you get the bad guys who are trying to hurt the sick people. And I was like, first of all, that tells me that he knows more about my job than my husband. So appreciate that from my 4-year-old. But then I was like, you know what? What a great perspective. And when I was thinking about all of you guys, the image of service and mission and integrity were the things that were just so top of mind for me for each one of you guys, because you truly have invested in helping our communities, right? Like whether that's the companies that you've partnered with and the relationships that you formed with us and with my team and just, you know, NHCA, like you name it, you guys are just so invested and committed to the mission of helping people and just making sure that there's integrity within that health system and within, you know, processes, and just that you're really supporting the community. And really, at the end of the day, I think it's so easy to forget that really that is what we are here for, is to stop the bad guys who are trying to hurt the sick people, right? And it's easy to forget that and to lose perspective about that. But you have all demonstrated to me that that is truly your motivating focus, that's your mission, that's your heart, that's your passion, that's your vocation. And I've really been changed and inspired by that from each one of you, truly, from the bottom of my heart. I've just seen that so with such clarity in the way that you approach your days and your lives and your perspectives. And it just, it's inspiring. It really is. And it's motivating and it's challenging and it's so appreciated. And I think it's also really unique, right? And so I think it's such a gift and a treasure that you embody that so well. And that just is such an integral part of who you are. And that's what makes you so amazing at what you do. So I am profoundly grateful for each one of you and for the ways that you have contributed to me and to my team and to just the presence that you have and the way that it just inspires greatness because of who you are. So I just want to say thank you to you guys.
Thank you.
That's beautiful.
Here.
Thank you.
I apparently went to a Taylor Swift concert. I don't even know what the hell that is.
Oh, my word.
Rarely are the gentlemen speechless. I love that, Christina. I think that was perfect, and I agree with you.
Well, we work for you. We don't get thanked very often.
That's not true.
Thank you so much, Christina. I appreciate it. And I do agree with you. Very much appreciate the message. Thank you. I see that we also have Jesse with us. Jesse, can you hear me? Christina, we got to get you this shirt next. This is the specific OIG roundtable shirt that Kia, our marketing person, hand drew. Can you believe that?
No. Wow.
I don't think I knew
You're
that.
Crazy. Is that what was on the email attachment with the banner? You drew that?
Kia drew it. She yes. is fantastic.
I am very highly impressed.
Thank you.
It's amazing. It's beautiful.
I keep thinking that we're going to go to a conference. I'm going to have a t-shirt gun, and I'm just going to launch advised t-shirts like you would see at a hockey game is what I want for us. Matt's a big hockey guy. Like, I think we should just do that. So maybe the OIG roundtable shirt's coming soon at a conference. Jesse, I know that you listen to our podcast, and thank you for wearing the shirt. Would you mind telling us anything that you think about the guys, about the podcast? We'd love to hear from you.
I love it. I started probably a year ago, I think. I switched jobs and I went from the provider space over to a health plan. And I went from doing coding, billing, auditing to investigation and auditing from the health plan side. And I'd actually reached out to Eric because I recognized him, I think, on LinkedIn. Must have been working from advise or something, but I originally recognized him from the compliance guy. So I'd asked him some questions, I think somewhere along the lines of if the AFI or the CFE was going to be required, if he thought it was necessary for me to go that route. And then I stumbled across the podcast. So I told him, oh, I just found this podcast. I'm going to jump right on that. And luckily, I'd been driving my dog to some training about 2 hours away at the time. So I had so much time to catch up on the podcast. And I don't even remember where it was, maybe at the time, number 40, 50, somewhere around there. So I had a lot of time, not enough time, because I haven't gotten to watch every single one. But I love them. I love all of the instruction. It's very actionable. you can listen to it and just take something away every single time you listen. And that's what I love, because I like to be able to, like, do my chores, my household chores, but listen to something like that. I'll put it on while I'm doing the dishes, and I have something to walk away with. I have something that I can put into practice, you know, the next day I go to work or shortly thereafter. Some of my favorite things, I think, is the consistency that is stressed with the SIU work. That's probably my number one thing. And the training. The training, I think, is so important and just gets bypassed in so many places, especially with the shortage of staffing. You know, you try to get somebody in and you just want to fill the place, but then you don't. Oftentimes it seems like people just are not given the necessary training, which I think becomes a trickle effect of not, or inefficient work. I can't say enough, really. I walk around like a dork, crazy. The compliance guy is my favorite thing, or the OIG roundtable, have you heard it? I'm like, oh my gosh, I should probably be talking about something different.
it's gratifying to hear this. It really is, because, you know, when we started these things, you know, like Eric, we didn't know we were going to have the content to make these things move. And plus, we didn't know if anybody was going to listen. And if what we said was anywhere near worthwhile to anyone, we were just talking about things we knew about. And to hear what Christina was saying about how it's helped her staff improve and give them something to shoot for in terms of goals, and what, you know, Jesse is saying about being actionable and stuff, that really hits home for me in terms of, you know, the impact we have, which is something we didn't know we had. And now it's, you know, it's really gratifying to hear that.
It's huge for me. I'm kind of a one-man team, or else I'd certainly be sharing it with my team. But I share it as much as I can.
Jesse, you're exactly right about the consistency and the training. This is something that Christina harps on, and I've heard and seen Christina actually make that actionable. I'm glad for the two of you ladies to meet. And I thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you so much for joining. Feel free to stay on if you'd like to. Otherwise, we're going to keep rolling through people. So it's like a big party today. It's us saying thank you to the guys. I see we have our next person who just joined us. Mr. Scott Ward, thank you for joining us today. I believe that you've had the unique opportunity of working with a couple of these gentlemen. So I would love to hear anything you and Omar may want to roast, if you want to make a couple of jokes of our OIG guys, anything you want. Thank you for being here, both of you.
Well, thank you. Omar probably has a little bit deeper connection than I do. So Omar, I'll yield to you.
Is that how we're starting off this convo, with deep connections, like right off the bat? I love it. Eric, what's up, buddy?
How are you, Omar?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. Look at this great cast. Way, Jay, Matt, what's up, buddy?
Hey, man.
I had a dream about you, Matt. I'll talk to you later.
Offline. It's kind of odd that I'm
dreaming about you. Yeah. Dan, how you doing, buddy? Jean Marie, thank you for putting this together. This is awesome. You know, you have first impressions, right? And so there are a number of impressions that Eric had left, but here's the first one that I clearly remember. So I got paired up with John Schofield as my mentor. And I was interning. I felt pretty good, right? I was coming on as an outstanding scholar, right? That whole program back then, it was now the Pathways program. But either way, we had a pretty liberal interning, you know, kind of process. And so I actually got out with John to do an interview, and he asked me to write it up. And so I came back to the office and I wrote it up, handed it to him. And he comes into my office and he says, you know, people keep saying how fucking smart you are, and I just don't see it. And he throws the interview at me, right? It's all written, you know, bloodied up. And I'm feeling pretty down on myself, right? I'm like, damn, you know, I felt like I can write pretty good. That was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning. And just after lunch, come back to the office, and the SAC at the time comes out of his office and bellows, "Omar, get your F&A over here now." And mind you, I'm at the very far end of the office and there's cubicles everywhere. And so clearly all these heads start popping up, you know, out of the office or out of the cubicles. And as I walk down, you know, kind of shame row and I'm getting closer, I'm thinking, man, I know he asked me to do this. I've checked this off. I've done this. I've done that. And I get up to the office and your cube was not far from him and Eric was across, right? So I go between the two of you as I get to John. And John says, "I hear congratulations are in order. You graduated and do you want to be an agent?" "Of course, yes, I want to be an agent. This is great." And so, you know, cheers and high fives, whatever. And Eric, you know, comes up to me and he says, "Hey, man, congratulations. I have a gift for you." And I was like, wow, of all the people in the office, like maybe he was in on this. And he asked me a gift and he says, "Hey, I have a change of underwear for you." That was Eric. You know, I felt loved of all the people that could have shitted myself on the way. And he says, "Here's a change of underwear for you." That was Eric's first impression. And then he says to me,
I was looking out for you. I didn't want you to go in there with stinky drawers.
But this is after the fact, which is again why I appreciated that you were there for me, right?
Right. I didn't want you walking around with stinky drawers. I wanted to be the positive role model.
I know it was a little bit more selfish than that, you know. I think later on that day we were going out and you didn't want, you know, me to be with you or to have flashbacks of your EMT days where, you know, you had to deal with someone who had, you know, pooped themselves. But yeah, then he goes on to say in some other breath, he says, "Man, you know, how old are you? You seem pretty young." And I was like, "Yeah, you know, thanks. I'm 21. And he was like, "Yeah, man, you're so effing lucky." And so I know we're on a podcast, right? So I'm being mindful. Like I dropped a couple
bombs. This is earlier, the Advice podcast. Speak freely, please. Oh, thank you. Shit.
You should have said that from the beginning. Lead with that. So yeah, he says, "Man, you're so fucking lucky. You know, I had to wait forever and I applied, you know, 6 times on triplicate, you know, and, you know, the SF50 back then was in triplicate, but I think so. Either way, he says, "Man, you're so lucky to get in. You know, I'm 30 something years old and I finally got in." And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know, maybe just I'm smarter than you. I am on the Outstanding Scholar Program. I don't know.
I'll second that. As would Jason.
Second that, right? So I had to give him a little bit, right? Because he was, but he was always cool. You know, Eric, I looked up to you a lot. I remember you pulled up one day in your Jaguar. I think it was the X6, X3, right? It's kind of like a little minty green thing. And I was like, "Man, this is cool. This guy is who I want to emulate," right? And he was just super versed. One thing he taught me, and all kidding, you know, kidding all aside, was focus on the basics and try to kind of hone what your purpose is, right? And I saw him always focusing on the basics. And that's where he, you know, was able to do fantastic work. And I appreciate you taking me under your wing. When you needed to roast me, you did. When you needed to pull my, you know, ears, you did. But I think all in all, you were always looking out for me, always trying to push me. And I can't thank you enough for doing that. I appreciate you roping me into your jiu-jitsu world back in the day, right? I just bought the house in East Brunswick. And he was like, "Man, I'm training jiu-jitsu. You want to come?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so. I don't want my ears to be as cauliflowered as yours, but I think I can do it. Just wear, just wear earmuffs and we'll be good to go." But yeah, man, Eric, I love you, dude. I appreciate all that you've done, you know, for this organization, for OIG when you were here. You know, certainly, I think speaking of luck, you lucked out, right? And however, whatever your path was to link up with Jean-Marie, you did. And you're doing great work at Advise. And so thank you for continuing to be, you know, a voice in this particular space. Thank you for championing all of us the way that you have. And oversight, you know, and accountability the way that you do. And I can't thank you enough, man.
For the record, it wasn't a Jaguar. It was an Impala, but you were so broke, you couldn't tell the difference.
No, okay, well, that is true back then, right? But I clearly remember the Jaguar. It was a two-door, if memory serves me. And again, it was like a greenish color because I was remember that's what I wanted. Yeah, see, Jean-Marie is like, yeah.
It was a four door and it was blue.
He makes it the was, jokes because he's getting teary. I hear him in the other room. You've touched his heart. I could hear him doing a little ugly cry. And I know Tom understands what I'm talking about because Tom knows Eric very well. And I could hear him do like, and he gives a little bit of water and then makes a joke. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
More of the OIG greats. We're getting to you, Scott, in a minute. Thank you, Tom, for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I'm just bummed that Eric never gave me underwear. In all the years I've known him. I mean, you know, he gave me a lot of insight, gave me a lot of grief, maybe a lap or two, but never underwear. So different relationship.
Did he give you a wedgie?
No, not even that.
Not even a wedgie?
Well, maybe the initiation wedgie when I joined. I mean, there could be that. So.
The problem was I knew you've always preferred a thong over boxer briefs, and I thought that was a little weird for a man to give another man a pair of, you know, thong. I tried it with Jason when he was my mentor. It was very awkward for about a week.
And speaking of that,
he did come into work and say he felt very pretty. So I felt it was okay.
By the way, I do have to say that I'm, you know, this is exciting for me because I was mentored by not just one person on this call, but two people on the call, both Eric and Jason. So that is kind of cool. So I do appreciate that.
So incorrigible. You were so incorrigible.
I noticed that you needed more gray-haired guys on this call, too.
You were incorrigible, so you had to be moved from person to person.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. Okay, go ahead, G-Marie. I know you were going to say something.
Please. This is just an opportunity for us to celebrate the guys. So this was the OIG Roundtable was something we started because I wanted our clients who are on the commercial side to hear live things that real guys had to say. And they asked me when they started, like, what could we say? What can't we say? And I said, you will not say things more than I won't say things because I'll just go out there and say whatever I feel like, as I'm sure everybody here is aware. So Tom, thank you for joining us. I like to see the collaboration. When I look around here, I see a good representation of healthcare, fraud, waste, and abuse, the actual people doing the good work. So if you want to make fun of any of the guys, any of your mentors, Tom, feel free. It's whatever you want. Thank you for helping us celebrate them.
Thanks. No, I do have one quick story, though, I want to mention. And just for new clients coming in, the kind of respect and kind of the personalization that you get, and you know, Omar talked about when he first started, I'll tell you when I first started, and this just shows what a good team Eric and Jason are working together. So I start, and this is, you know, 100 years ago, so I'm a brand new bright-eyed agent in New York, and I walk in, and I start, of course, like the beginning of December, which, by the way, for those of you who aren't familiar with the government, beginning of December is the beginning of leave season, so there's really not a lot of people in the office. So Jason tells me, hey, why don't you review cases? You know, why don't you review a case? Go talk to Eric. And Eric gives me this case, and it's this giant, Eric, do you remember? It was this giant case, the ophthalmologist with three that operated on three eyes.
Former Dr. Carl Frommer from Victory Boulevard in Staten Island.
So these two guys work together to get the new guy to sit there for the next like 3 weeks before I go to the academy reading this case page by page. And this is back when we had paper. And I'm convinced that it was hazing. It was probably worse than the initiation wedgie that we talked about. But it was this giant, back when we used paper. I mean, it was bundles and bundles of paper and just sitting there. And I'm thinking to myself, what did I get myself into? Like, what am I doing here? But on a serious note, it was really funny because these two guys worked together to torture me for my first week or two. Jason was my supervisor. Eric was my alleged mentor. But I learned so much from these guys. So it really was, I question, you know, my life's decisions for that moment when I was on like the fifth binder of the 12 binder case file. But it was cool. I learned a lot from these guys, and I probably, honestly, I would not have been as successful as an investigator. I would not, know as much about healthcare, probably still not as much as these guys, without their help, but thank you. And we still tell stories about the doctor who, every patient had three eyes. So, you know, 25 years later, we still talk about that. But again, thanks for having me here. I'm stoked to be here. So
Matt, documentation, it's the key to successful cases, right? Documentation.
Yep. And not to over document. 12 binders.
I don't know. I think that's an exaggeration from Thomas.
There's probably 15.
Scott, I have to ask you, have you listened to a single one of these podcasts? What do you even think about this?
Well, I'm looking across the screen and I'm thinking to myself, because I know Tom and Omar a little bit, but not as well as I know Eric, Jason, and Matt and Wade. And I'm thinking about, you know, when I remembered when Eric actually had hair and when Jason and Matt and Wade's hair was a different color. That's how long I've been around or whatever. But I think, you know, because I've worked at different levels with all of them, and I'm saving the really good stories for the podcast that Omar and I are going to start separately, because, you know, that one's going to have to be like, you know, after Howard Stern or something, because it's some really dark stories. But I think it didn't really resonate with me until I saw Jason and Eric together, and then it hit me, you know, because I'm a big movie buff, and I realized it's like Smokey the Bandit in real life. It's big-ness and little-ness for the OIG, you know, and all I could see them is wearing the same outfits. And it made sense because it's like Eric emulates Jason in so many ways. And I thought there wasn't anybody else that could have that until I got a little bit deeper relationship with Matt Kachansky a little bit too. And I started trying to figure out if Matt and Jason might be related in some way because they have such similarities. But the stories that these guys have, you know, it resonates with all of us, you know, quite a bit. Yeah, I could see that, but I don't think that's a good, you know, assessment either. I like the big-ness, little-ness. I'm gonna get something for, get Kia to work on something like that for us, your new material. So,
Scott, while you were talking, I saw that Eric was on Amazon ordering a neckerchief to match Jason's.
Well, it's either that or the you know, I didn't think anybody ever wore the ascot until I started working with Jason, and he shows up at like a corporate event when he's retired from OIG, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, you know. And you know, I got so much material from that. But on a serious note though, all of these guys, like they have made their mark in healthcare quite a bit. And then, you know, when you look at all of them after they've retired, you know, and you start with Jason, you know, after he retired from OI and he came into the corporate world, and you saw Matt, you know, in there at the same time, they really, you know, put a different perspective and changed the way that we did, you know, fraud, waste, and abuse investigations, you know, from the private side, from the go between OIG and between CMS. And it's really forever changed in a much positive way. And also with Wade, when Wade, you know, put his mark on it. And now, you know, since Eric has retired too, he's put a little bit different spin on it. You know, he's doing multiple things and he's showing how you can broach different markets and things of that nature. And that's really important, you know, and I'm happy to be working with all of them as we move forward into the future of these things. Now, Eric's selling a little bit different snake oil than what Matt and Jason and Wade were selling, but, you know, people are starting to buy it. So, you know, it's good. It's a good diversity on a serious note.
I don't even know if Eric could respond to that. But Dan seems to like it. Dan, what do you think about that?
I'm selling that snake oil with Eric every day. I love it.
We really do appreciate this very much. Scott, thank you. And what you said is true. That really is an evolution for this team. And we here at Advise, we do things a little bit sometimes on the fly. You know, we just go and get it done, which is very similar to how we plan today. We have people joining, we have people dropping off, and basically it was a way for us to just say thank you to our OIG roundtable for everything that they do. And I just wanted to invite the fans, people who have been part of the roundtable, people who watch the roundtable. I see we just had Lorraine and Steven join us, and Also, Megan McCarthy coming in, who is very special to us. Eric, do you want to tell everybody about how you know Lorraine and Megan?
Lorraine and Megan are with Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield New Jersey on the commercial side. And I think I've known Megan probably close to 25 years. I've known Lorraine for probably 15, maybe even 20 years. They were our main points of contact at the OIG for the commercial work that we did with Horizon. I got to work with Lorraine pretty closely on some cases, and obviously Megan is the manager of that group. And then, of course, Stephen, who is not with Horizon. Stephen, for those who have been on the podcast or watched the podcast, rather, have met Stephen virtually through the podcast and really through the LinkedIn Live that we did to talk about a great case that we worked on. And for those that don't know, Stephen is a former assistant U.S. attorney out of Chicago, worked healthcare, and then went to the private sector and is a defense attorney now. And he's one of the few healthcare-centric lawyers who actually understands data, understands the importance of data in fraud, waste, abuse cases, and has had some great successes in defending people that have been ultimately wrongfully accused, or rightfully accused in the government's perspective, but wrongfully accused in Stephen Lee's perspective. So I've gotten to work on a few things with Stephen and have picked each other's brains, and it's been great. And if I was ever in a position where I was getting in some trouble for healthcare stuff, Stephen would be one of the defense attorneys that would be on my list of people to check into. So I appreciate you guys coming in and talking to us a little bit about the roundtable.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
I think about where everybody's sitting. We have a bunch of states represented here. I love this. I know Stephen's in Chicago. Megan and Lorraine, you're in our backyard. So, ladies, I've worked with you so many years. You're actually, I look at Megan, she's the reason I met Eric. So she's the reason we're all sitting here today. Thank you, Megan, for setting all this up. Thank you. Changed advice. So thank you, Megan. We appreciate it. I know that you and Lorraine actually listened to the podcast. I want to say thank you very, very much. Really appreciate it. As we look towards our next 100 episodes, is there anything that you would like to see more of or less of? Is there anything you want to tell the guys? Hey, Eric talks too much. Is there anything you want to say like that? Please tell us.
Well, Eric can never talk enough. Yeah, he doesn't talk too much, I don't think. No, it's very informative. A lot of what I learn a lot of from the Medicare side of things. Both Lorraine and I investigate commercial lines of business, but I really feel that we learn a lot about from the Medicaid side, or Medicare side of business, from Eric's discussions with Matt and Dan and Wade McFall, who used to work at Horizon. We miss you, Wade, very much. It's good to see you.
No, Lorraine, yes. Did you want to say Eric, anything? I love the your podcast, your roundtables. And what I love about it, and what I've loved about Eric whenever he gives a presentation, he knows how to keep those people informed, involved. You don't have us falling asleep. You know, we go through so many webinars and roundtables and podcasts. You make it so comfortable and easy to understand. And that's what I love attending them. I mean, not only you guys doing 100 episodes or roundtables, but we've been through 100, you know, different training sessions. So it's very refreshing. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Eric, you keep it fresh. New schemes, what you guys are seeing on your end. It's interesting to us because we don't always see the same types of cases. So it's good that we learn new things. So we really do appreciate that.
That's so kind.
And no, we appreciate you guys. I can't believe it's been 100 episodes. Went by fast.
Yeah. You know, I think for our perspective, the thing that makes the OIG Roundtable a little unique is while Wade and Matt and Jason and I all come from that same cloth, we really do have a lot of different paths in the way that we did things, right? You know, Matt and Jason went into OIG leadership and then went on to run the UPICs. And I don't think that necessarily people appreciate the inside baseball that comes with having run a UPIC. and mm-hmm. the importance of understanding those workflows. It's, you know, it's like having people who directly were involved with determining how cases went, and to know that inside baseball is a really important piece of the puzzle, understanding those workflows. And Wade bringing in the mid-level supervisory perspective from the OIG, and then how do those mid-level supervisory decisions work in the private sector when we all retire and decide, you know, to move on into other things. And then, you know, my perspective is having never applied for a management position and just wanting to work cases. I always loved just being a case agent, and it never dawned on me to ever get promoted up because I just loved working the cases and doing the work that was important to be done and bringing that forward. So it, for us, the, you know, the value we get is when we see instances of people commenting on our LinkedIn lives or sending us messages or emails about a topic or something like that. I can't tell how many people have, like, for example, when they apply for a job here and they say, you know, I reviewed the podcast about X, Y, and Z, and it resonated. It made me interested in wanting to come work here. So it's as much of a reflection outward as it is inward for us.
Thank you for that. And Eric, how did you originally meet Stephen? How did you and Stephen, please.
So Stephen is Stephen's associated, not from a legal partnership, but associated with a lawyer named Hillary LeCicero, who was at a firm in D.C. And she was representing a doctor by the name of Richard Paulus, who had been tried and convicted after jury trial, not once, but twice, including a bunch of cases that were appealed up through the second and or through his local circuit. I got involved when it was going to be Dr. Paulus's second or third time around in the trial. And Stephen had come in and worked very closely with Hillary on sort of disproving the government's theory on that case. I had been involved in the early part of the Dr. Paulus in his first case in the sentencing, where the government was really overreaching. They were trying to hold Dr. Paulus accountable for billed amounts for patients that were inpatient at a hospital in which 90%+, I may be exaggerating a little bit, but 90%+ of the time that the patient spent in the hospital, Dr. Paulus had no involvement, no interaction, no dealing with the patient whatsoever until the very end of their stay when they had a stent and an angioplasty done. And I just thought that in trying to hold this doctor accountable for billed amounts, which are made up out of the ether, that it was just not right. And I think my definition of billed amounts are they're made up numbers, and it's horseshit if anybody believes that it's other than a made up number. So that's how I got to meet Hillary. And then in Dr. Paulus's retrial, I helped a little bit behind the scenes in some of that. So that's how I got to meet Stephen, was through Hillary, and, you know, have been able to forge that friendship with a lot of the lawyers that we do work with here, have become like friends of advice, so to speak, where, you know, I think an important piece for us is to say that not every single time you speak to somebody is a billable event. And I think it's important to do that. And one of my favorite phrases is I talk myself out of business all the time, because I think that right is right and wrong is wrong. And Matt Wade and Jason and I, we talk about this all the time, that, you know, the business is going to be there and people are going to come to us because of, you know, ultimately when there's that need. But Stephen and I speak frequently, and he never gets an invoice for those conversations, because it's sometimes important just to forge those relationships and be able to share knowledge with people. And they'll remember that when the time comes when there is a need for us to be, you know, used as a consultant or an advisor. And in probably every one of the projects we've done, Wade, Matt, Jason, or I, or the collective, have been able to put sort of our experience and our education to helping people understand what the issues are, because right is right and wrong is wrong, right? And you still have to be on the fence. And if someone has done something wrong, the question is the government's case overreaching? Is it appropriate? Are the loss amounts right? Is there a way to mitigate some of those loss amounts and make it more commensurate with what the crime was that was committed? Or is the government's theory just entirely wrong? And sometimes it is wrong. And so I think we try to be that voice of reason for the clients that we have here.
Yeah, so let me just bounce off that a little bit, because yeah, it was great. It was great getting to meet Eric, and really, you know, look, I didn't work with him back when he was in the government, but you know, look, I've worked with a lot of government agents when I was a prosecutor, and look, you know, there's a range, right? And like Eric's clearly was, you know, he knows his stuff so well, and he's so passionate about his cases and working them up and working them up right. And I think that's really important, because these cases, they sound simple, you know, they sound simple in the press release and stuff like that, but most of these cases are usually really complicated, and a lot of them do hinge on the nuances, and that's really important. And that's where people like Eric are really great at kind of really getting to the heart of the key details of a case. So, for example, with the case that he was talking about, the Dr. Paulus case, that's one where, you know, I mean, look, I get it. Given his numbers, I mean, yeah, totally understand why the government would take a look at him. And so that's the thing. Eric was talking about, like, how the government looks at people. Like, I've most of my cases, I don't disagree with the government taking a look. I totally see why the government looked at a particular person. But did they actually do it right? And I think the Paulus case was a good example of one where, you know, there were some mistakes that were made, some bad assumptions that were made along the way. And, you know, and it really does require people who really know how the UPICs work, how the government works, to really go back and unpack that and then be able to explain that to a jury. And Eric was a big part of trying to help do that with the first Paulus trial. In the second Paulus trial, he didn't end up testifying, but yeah, he was really helpful behind the scenes in helping us deal with a Hail Mary pass by the government, because we had successfully kept out like one really improper peer comparison that the government had tried to use, where they just basically picked a few hospitals around the country and compared my client to those hospitals. It's like, those aren't similar hospitals. They're not in the same region. They don't specialize the same thing. They're not comparable. So we kept those out, and the government tried to introduce a time study into evidence. And look, I think everyone here who's dealt with them knows those are very good investigative tools, but they're not the kind of thing that I think, you know, really are useful as evidence in a trial. And so this was like 2 weeks before the trial that the government dumped this on us. So I'm recalling Eric and like, okay, I need to figure out how to get this, keep this out of the case, like, fast. And like, Eric was great in like helping me brainstorm. And, you know, really kind of to the point where we were able to keep it out because it was going to, it would change the entire dynamic of the trial. We would have spent a few days kind of explaining to a jury why time studies aren't that reliable and why they're all the criticism, all of which, none of which had anything to do with the actual merits of the case. So, and that's why it's so great to be able to tap into people who really know how things should be done. And then it can help us figure out where things went wrong, because, you know, and that's really important, because, you know, look, I think my general take is that, especially in a field like healthcare, people make mistakes all the time on both sides, you know, on all sides, people make mistakes. Mistakes happen, right? But figuring out, like, a mistake isn't a crime. And so figuring out, you know, is the government making a proper accusation, or are they making mistakes? And then that's a big part of figuring out. And that's why people like Eric are so great.
Well, and Matt, we talk about this all the time, so let's actually make this part of an actual OIG podcast. But we talk all the time, and I know, and Jason and I have this discussion about how data lies to you until it's telling the truth. And, you know, I think Jason and I have a little bit different opinion of it, but I think that data always lies until you've corroborated it. And that's where we get into that human element. But Matt, we talk a lot when we do our podcasts, and we talk offline a lot about the fact that impossible days today are not impossible days of years ago, particularly since the guidelines changed, right? The CPT guidelines changed in 2021, and they're not inherently based upon the time function anymore. It's medical decision-making collaterally with time. And so, you know, when we get cases sent to us by our external partners on our SIU team, where the analytics have identified an impossible day, particularly with E&M codes, the very first thing you have to do is look at that with a grain of salt. And when we were all involved with teaching at our special agent basic training, I would do a block of instruction on some of these fraud schemes, and I would talk about physical therapy is the biggest liar when it comes to time, because in the CPT book, it says one-on-one with provider, 15 minutes is one unit. But in the CMS world, a unit is 8 to 21 minutes, I think, right? So, or 16 minutes. So you've got this vacillation on a unit. And so the data lies to you all the time. And one of the things that Stephen is really good at doing when we've talked about cases is identifying those instances where the data is being used to the benefit of the person using it, right? And Matt, we talk about this all the time, that that grain of salt is an important grain of salt because you still need that human element.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's so many variables in any type of an impossible day scenario. PT, you've got other types of providers that can providing those services concurrently, aides and assistants under the supervision of the PT. But those things can be going on at the same time as opposed to consecutively, which makes the impossible day look like it's bigger than it actually is. And you can't take those things into consideration by looking at data. You've got to go out and do the interviews and get the medical records and validate the data before you take any action.
Totally agree with that. Both back as a prosecutor and now now on the defense side. Data is great. And you can tell a lot of stuff with data, but I would never rely on just data, right? In making a decision as momentous as bring a criminal charge or even suspension, right? I mean, you want to you want to do something more, right? It's definitely worth totally get why it might be enough to start an audit, right? It might be enough to start an audit, to start an investigation, but you got to need more. I mean, and that happened a lot. That did happen in the Paulus case where, the way the government, and that actually was a pretty crucial mistake. And it wasn't necessarily that data lied. It's not complete, right? And that's one that basically because my guy was an outlier on an absolute number, and he did bill a lot of procedures. And I'm sure the government thought that he was doing impossible days, but it turned out he really did work crazy, crazy hours. He really did. And if they had actually asked people at the hospital, they would have told him that, the government that. But they also, didn't compare him to his patient population. And once you factor those in, he really wasn't an outlier. And it really, but unfortunately, that kind of mistake early on, that failure to account for that, I mean, that kind of is what led to basically a decade-long fight that ultimately finally resulted in his getting cleared. But yeah, it's not enough. As much as I love it, it's not enough.
And not that I want to make this a discussion about data or data analytics, but Omar, since you're here, and for those that don't know Omar not only was an agent at the OIG, but he was also an assistant special agent in charge in Miami, and then was also the special agent in charge in Miami, and is now working on some special projects directly for headquarters involving international work. But Omar was down in Miami when the first strike force city, which was Miami, took place, and Omar supervised that. And the early cases in Strikeforce, right, Omar, data analytic driven, and data analytics was actually the foundation for a lot of the other strike forces. So we can't discount data. A lot of the cases that started in Miami in the early days of Strikeforce were data driven. So data really is a foundational start, right? But Omar, it's certainly not the end, right? You're not going out and charging people for just based upon data analytics. That human element will always have to be part of that investigative continuum.
Exactly right. I think no clear example. It probably happened to all of us, right? You swipe your credit card. It's a purchase you haven't really done before, and it's blocked because the data points to an aberrant purchase. It's doing its job, right? It's flagging something, but we certainly understand, and I think we've really created our division of data analytics has gotten a lot more refined in terms of certainly identifying anomalies, pointing towards flags, but then combining it with a lot of other data sets to really determine whether or not this particular provider is in fact committing or indicative of some type of fraud. But to your point, is we take that as just a starting point, and we always love to we make sure that we're including the human intelligence piece of it, also the OSINT piece, right? As part of a complete data set. But To your point, I think there's data that's always being looked at and being ingested. But I think one of the things that we'll always be considering is, especially with the advent of AI and how that may or may not influence what the data looks like, right? And so there's going to have to certainly be some additional human contact to make sure that we can pierce through what the data is pointing towards.
I know that AI is the big thing I keep talking about with my clients, right? So as providers get AI and payers have AI, how are they going to interface with that? So interesting, Omar, when you're talking the data, I see Megan shaking her head. I think back to your case of the year, Megan, and I'm not sure how much everyone on this call or even listening knows about your case, but this was a pretty big deal. So Megan got this award, Megan's team. Did you work with Tom on this? I know you worked with John. Was Tom on it? So I'm glad that
Tom was on it too. Tom was on it in the beginning.
Tell us about that. I want to make sure everybody knows about it because it was amazing.
Thank you for saying that. Appreciate that. It was a laboratory located here in New Jersey that was, it went from 0 to 100, and we used data to really kind of identify that this particular laboratory became an outlier very quickly on. And, you know, if anyone knows anything about fast moving cases, when you see that kind of growth within a non-participating laboratory, you often kind of go to that place that this is something nefarious is going on here. So I had gotten the case, started making some phone calls to patients to find out, like, why were they getting this much blood work? What was the reason behind it? There were some patients early on that were, you know, had gone to an urgent care center because they had broken their arm and left the urgent care center with like $3,000 worth of blood work when they were just getting their arm set. And I couldn't understand the correlation. So started asking some questions with the patients. Then that graduated to going out and interviewing some of our participating providers. Lo and behold, the providers had entered into a special arrangement with the laboratory by where they were paying a rent to the laboratory. The laboratory was paying a rent to the providers in exchange, ultimately, for their blood work. And that was like really the scheme behind it all. And also, they, unbeknownst to me at the time, that the providers had also entered into a special service agreement with the providers, and they were getting paid for time when they had their own employees taking blood work, but at the same time, the lab was supplying them with a phlebotomist on site. So when that phlebotomist wasn't there, supposedly, their own employees would have to take the blood work, and there was a payment for that type of arrangement. I did work at times with Tom Flores, with Eric, and with John Cruz as well. John Cruz and I worked on it as well. A couple other FBI agents in the beginning stages of the case. But I ended up getting one participating, one agreement with one of the providers who were getting paid for a rent. They were getting like $3,500 a month for the rent. Their own rent for the space, they may have been paying about $2,000 a month. So they were getting in excess of what their own rent for the whole entire office was. He ultimately went to trial and lost. I think he was the only doctor that went to trial, and he ultimately died in jail. So sad story in the end, but yeah, it was a good case. It was a very good case. Thanks for bringing that up.
Hey, Jean-Marie, if I could jump in real quick too, like, you know, and circling back to, not to make it a commercial for you guys or anything, but, it's just a great, you know, so it's a great example, like this partnership, and, mm-hmm. and I'll get back to something that Eric said too, is just this partnership. Megan, you know, did this amazing, amazing product. And then just, it's so nonchalant, you know, like she downplays a little bit, but it's like, it was an FBI agent named Mary. It was like, hey, Tom, Mary, want to come over? I want to talk to you guys about this case. Yeah. Just this so nonchalant. And, you know, 10 years later, an NHCA award later, you know, investigation of the year, 53 defendants, 150-ish million in recovery. You know, like, there's, you know, so Megan downplays a little bit, but I mean, she was the catalyst to that investigation. We also love the fact, I mean, it's so New Jersey and New York. It's, if you could find a way to bribe and kickback, you know, give kickbacks to people, they found a way. I mean, and the defendant was so funny too, because not only did they bribed private, they bribed, you know, Medicare docs. If there was a doctor out there, they found a way to either bribe them or provide kickbacks. And it was everything from, you know, these exorbitant rent reimbursement and these weird, like, business reimbursement agreements to, you know, Super Bowl tickets and all that stuff. But it was so New Jersey, New York bribery kickbacks. I mean, it really was that, you know, that quintessential case like that.
Phone cards on The Sopranos. Do you remember that episode? Yes.
some of our current criminal politicians could have learned a lot about how to properly accept a bribe or a kickback. You know.
Eric, I'm going to digress for a minute. It reminds me of one of your cases where we're sitting in Newark or standing in Newark in a car, literally counting tens of thousands of dollars. I'm surprised Eric never got me killed. I'm not going to lie. I guess I'm friends with him because he didn't get me killed, but there were days where, you know, those kickbacks are always hard to trace, you know, just the cash in hand. But, you know, Megan's case, our case, it was these things that were somewhat easy to track, you know. But it goes back to, Eric, something you said before, two things. One, that data lies thing, you should name a podcast after that. That's a great title. I know you have one already. It's commercial. But the second thing too is, you know, stuff like this, it's one of your other podcasts, you talk about quality cases and you talk about how to produce them. And one of the things I do love, and this is where I guess my commercial starts, one of the things I love with what you're doing with your podcast is you're giving different perspectives, right? And me as an OIG agent, I might not really know what Megan's doing or what some of the other people are doing on that backside before they produce this case and present it to me. And then maybe the folks on the private insurance side don't know what we do once they present that case to us. And I do really dig that about the podcast. And that one, I don't remember what the title was, but it was a while back. I think you and Wade talked about, like, you know, putting quality cases together. And it was cool because it gives you different perspectives. So the folks who don't know the other person's perspective really learn. So I do appreciate that. You know, I just thought it was cool, and it's really neat. And believe it or not, I do actually watch and listen to you, even in my nightmares as well as real life. I do listen and hear your voice in my head. So, but Megan, it's great seeing you, and thanks for
great
mentioning
you
that.
Too.
That
was,
you know, case. You know, what's funny is about a month ago, I went to a retirement party. One of our coworkers from the New York region was retiring, and a newer agent was there who had started about 6 months before I retired. So I retired in January of 19. He started, I think, in the summer of 18. He was a New Jersey Mifuku Medicaid Fraud Control Unit detective, came over. Super guy. And when I saw him at the retirement party, he said, listen, I hope that you guys aren't planning on pulling the plug on the OIG roundtable. He says, I learned more from watching your podcast about what's going on in the healthcare fraud space than I have time to research in the day. And, you know, he was kind of making a joke about it, but it resonated because it's something to us that's very important. We have people like Jesse, who's an SIU investigator, newer SIU investigator, but a really good auditor. She's got two or three certifications in coding and auditing. So she's one of the people who makes that transition. And we get a lot of people reaching out to us and asking about those kind of transitions. And so when we have people like Jesse, who have spent a career in auditing and coding, and now they're on the SIU side, and, you know, she'll reach out with a question about this or a question about that. And then you see the OIG people who are supposed to be those subject matter experts, and they're telling us that the things that, you know, we're doing on the podcast are helping them understand that landscape is pretty good. It, you know, I'm not saying it gives me hope for the future, but it certainly is an important piece that when, you know, they're talking about hearing Wade's perspective from the mid-level manager and then over to the commercial side, or Matt or Jason's perspective from a leadership perspective, from, you know, kind of that nuanced expertise, and then Matt's experiences in running the SIU on our end. It really does make a difference because people are, you know, we're getting that feedback from people that we never really thought we'd be getting.
I would like to take an opportunity to say this is a very I told you so moment. So when we were thinking about doing this podcast, look at Eric's face. I could see him twitching and biting his lip already, and I know Tom and Omar know exactly what I'm talking about. So when we were talking about doing this podcast, I said to Eric, hey, look, there's things I want to talk about. Like, I really want your opinion. I always would ask, like, when I first met Eric, I said to him, I just have to know how it really works on that side. Is it like what I think it is? Are you going through like data to find the case? Are you driving by doctor's offices? What's happening? Because I had no idea. I really just didn't know. I knew my clients. I knew the audits that we did. I didn't really understand anything about investigations. And I'm sure Matt could tell you, I still don't understand anything about investigations. But I do have a big appreciation. And so I will say that it's interesting to me how topics are just constantly coming out where it's, you know, what's old is new. We say that's old all the time on the podcast, but when we see like the same stuff over it again, and also new things like a new person entering just now, which Jason, this is really your lineage, so Jason, thank you very much. Hello, Susan Frisco, thank you for joining us today.
Hi everyone,
it's a party. We appreciate
this. It's so exciting.
Wait till you see this. We have April. So these are OIG ladies. We always refer to OIG guys, but this is really the heart of the OIG. I'm so proud to see this female leadership here. Susan, I have to tell you, April gave a big presentation last week, and she really kicked ass. I'm so proud to see the OIG ladies. So when I say guys, I use like New York, you guys, but I really mean ladies. Susan, tell people about yourself. I want people on this call. I think most everybody knows you, but like, say anything. Like, you're amazing. You just retired. Oh, you're doing great stuff. Tell us.
Okay, now I'm blushing. It's hard for me to blush. I appreciate that. That's very sweet. I actually retired from HHS OIG at the end of December, so almost coming up on a year. I can't believe it. It's been, I had a great career. I was a special agent and a supervisory special agent for about 28 years. So I was a very long run, 18 of the years as a supervisor and 10 years in the field. But I had the pleasure of being mentored by Jason and working alongside of him and Eric for many years. Two really of the greatest, I couldn't have asked for really better mentoring and partnership throughout the years. I always said, you know, I don't mean to blow up your head yet, Eric, but like, he was usually the smartest guy in the room, you know? So
I hate to be in that room.
And he's wait, you're talking about Eric?
He's a little bit of a pain in the ass, but he's, you know, he literally like knew everything, and he's the kind of guy that just retained information. So it's like he learned about a case, and you know, when if I had a case, like the case was over and I sort of forgot about it, but he has this like encyclopedia in his brain that's like really remarkable. And you know, Jason, you were really an incredible mentor for me, so I learned a lot from you. I started as a little, you know, fresh out of college. I didn't know anything, very naive and green, and didn't really even know what kind of work I was getting into. But Jason really guided me and led me along a great path and a great career. So I'm really fortunate to have worked with these guys. And Matt, we worked together. And Wade, I don't know if we may have crossed paths at some point, but it's been a pleasure working with you guys. So excited to be here. And April, I'm sorry. Sorry, I missed you.
We love April. So I am thrilled that April is advised. I have to just tell you, her leadership here has been tremendous. So she's our director of our SIU New York plans. She does our, Matt, what is her official title?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, I feel like it's about that. So anyway, she does all of our New York clients. She's amazing leadership when it comes to quality, looking at cases, like really leading those clients and our team. She does a tremendous job. April, you retired very close to Susan. I feel like your parties were a couple of weeks apart. Tell everybody, because I feel like there's never enough female OIG leadership on our podcast. Tell everybody a little bit about your background, April, please. And then feel free to give jokes about the guys, because I feel like that's what today is about. It's a party.
Jean Marie, thank you. Susan, so good to see you. So good to see so many faces I haven't seen. Omar, Tom. I mean, this is great. Yeah, I retired in January, just a couple weeks after Susan. I said I needed a couple months off just to regroup because I was there since I was a baby, right, Susan?
Yeah.
23 years old, came out of college and started working for the government. And then, yes, I was also mentored by Eric, and Jason was my first supervisor, I think. First real supervisor. Thanks, Jason.
I was going to say, we're not going
to... We won't go there. No, we don't need to go there. But Jason was my first real supervisor. And I said it at my retirement, and I'll say it again. You know, back in the day when we started Susan, you know, women were not considered equal in the law enforcement world. And Eric and Jason, like, I so appreciate your guidance, your mentorship, and your, you know, your leadership, and, you know, kind of letting me learn the job and treating me like an equal. So I do appreciate that. I worked for Susan for a bit of time as well, and that was always wonderful. And it's hard to believe that so many years have passed, and now I'm on to career number two, loving advise and loving the people. We have such a good team in New York, and I was on the phone with one of the investigators today. Just she wanted to pick my brain, and I just loved, you know, being relational with her, and it's a good group of people. One of my favorite stories, which I have to bust Eric's chops about, was we were in seized computer evidence recovery at FLETC. Do you remember that, Eric? And there, what happens is when they have any openings that are federally canceled, you know, spots, they open it up to the Glenn County Police Department. And there was a gentleman in our class who was from Georgia, born and raised, clearly a local. And he was in the class, and Eric busted his chops the entire time. And then it was the last day when we were dealing with legal. And the question from the instructor, I don't remember what the question was about, but it was if you were allowed to do something. So Eric raised his hand and said, absolutely not. And then this gentleman from Glenn County raised his hand and said, absolutely you can. So it turns out that it wasn't legal, whatever it was, but the gentleman from Glenn County said, well, ma'am, you didn't ask if it was legal. You just asked if we could do it. So Eric proceeded to fill him in on how things work when they're kicking in trailer doors in Georgia. Remember, Eric? And so this gentleman, as calm as day, said, well, Mr. Eric, in Georgia, you can't kick in trailer doors. You need what we call a crowbar because they open out. So that was my favorite Eric story. Not sure if you remember that, Eric, but I do. Jean Marie, you're on mute, but I can see you laughing.
I don't remember that, but you know, I do remember that that instructor used the word medium in a variety of different ways that were very Southern, that weren't medium. Medium strip, a bunch of other things like that. It's a different world down there.
I would have to ask. Great. So, Scott, do you feel that we're very Northeast? Like, when you have interfaced with, I know you worked with Jason for a very long time. How was that?
Well, I'll just say this, working with Jason and Eric both, I say bless your heart quite a bit. And so, for those of you in the Northeast, when you say wish you well, bless your heart means the same thing. So...
It's probably like a God bless. I know my Jersey people know. I look at Tom and Omar. I know you know. God bless. Lisa moved. Lisa Taylor joined us. She moved from Jersey to Florida. And Lisa, your practice, because now I don't even know. Catch me up on that. Your practice is all over. I know you mainly were New Jersey. Tell us about that. And thank you for joining us. This is just a party. Nothing really set in stone. Just happy that you're here.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and, you know, it's great to see, you know, those of you I've worked with before, and, you know, I look forward to working with those of you I haven't worked with or interacted before. My practice is all over. I actually went to graduate school and law school in North Carolina, And I had no interest in going back to New Jersey, having grown up there, and went for 1 year to clerk on the New Jersey Supreme Court and spent a long time there. But because of that, I did have some fabulous opportunities, including, you know, certainly one of the highlights of my career, which was serving as counsel to the federal monitor for the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. And guess who signed the documents initiating that case? Eric. So, you know, there are, forget about 6 degrees of separation. There's, you know, very little separation. And that was the first time I had the opportunity to work with Eric, and was really a privilege. And so, you know, and certainly had lots of opportunities since then, but it really was a privilege. And I guess, Eric, if we go back, you know, time, and I guess it's almost 20 years now in terms of UMDNJ, what's the biggest takeaway? Your biggest takeaway from that? And for those of you who may not recall, that was a situation where the New Jersey's Health Sciences University, which at the time had 3 medical schools, a dental school, a school of health sciences, $1.5 billion budget, was committing Medicaid fraud. But, you know, if the federal government it's a subdivision, essentially, called the body corporate and politic of the state of New Jersey. So you had the federal government essentially in a position of prosecuting this New Jersey government. What a shock, for fraud. But instead, what happened was a deferred prosecution agreement was entered into. A monitor was appointed to try to clean up things. And as I said, I had the privilege of serving as healthcare counsel to the federal monitor. But Eric signed, it was the indictment, wasn't it? You're on mute, Eric.
It was the deferred prosecution agreement. But what's interesting is Susan, who's here, Susan actually had that case originally and then got promoted, and it went to me to kind of close out. So she had done the beginning piece, and then I brought it, finished it up, and then dealt with all of the collateral shenanigans that came about as a result of that, which included the cardiology fraud case involving the kickbacks, the civil cases, the Stark trial that no one understood, the 3 AUSAs who had never prosecuted a civil case in their career were all leaving the U.S. attorney's offices and wanted a trial under their belts and decided that it would be a good idea to prep 2 days before the trial on a civil case involving Stark, in which nobody had prosecuted a Stark case in the District of New Jersey ever. And there were only 2 of them that had been prosecuted. So it was a fun time, to say the least. And I guess I could thank Susan for getting promoted and giving me that case. But I think at the end of the day, we had close to 20 doctors enter into civil settlement agreements for the kickbacks. And I think we had 4 criminal prosecutions for healthcare fraud, kickbacks, and a bunch of other stuff. So it was good, and it was great. That was obviously our first foray. And, you know, I mentioned this yesterday. My dad would always say, be kind to the people you meet on the way up, because you're meeting them on the way down. But I think it also means you're meeting them in the parallels, right? So here it is, years later, the UMDNJ case was 2005, and we've advises then work for you, Lisa Taylor, in your private practice now. So it really is full circle. And when we talk about these kind of full circle things, you know, Matt was one of the very first people outside of the New York region when I first got hired that I met. And so here it is, you know, almost 30 years later, that I get to work with Matt and Wade, and, you know, it's like the full mentoring circle, right? That I walked in my very first day as an OIG agent, and I'm introduced to Jason as my mentor, and it's like 30 years later. I say to Jason, he's like a father figure to me. I say, you know, I don't know if I'd give you a kidney, but I'd at least think about it for a minute or two. So it really is, you know, like the 30-year cycle, and and doing the roundtable has been kind of a fun way to obviously remain and be connected to people who get to, you know, who get to share their expertise as well.
Well, it's nice to meet you, Susan, at least by Zoom, to have, anyhow, all these many years later. And for those of you, I think Eric knows, in terms of the clinical cardiologists and all of these doctors who were, you know, ultimately mostly settled civilly for these no-show jobs where the university was very blatantly paying them for referrals. I know Eric knows this, but I don't know if anyone else. The way that got started was as counsel to the federal monitor, you know, we had an obligation to clean up things. And on a Sunday at home, I got a telephone call from a doctor I knew who called me and said that one of the doctors was bragging in the doctor's locker room of one of the other hospitals that he had this no-show job at University Hospital. So that was what began, you know, one of the offshoots of the original deferred prosecution. So not only, you know, you got to be careful what you're saying to whom and where too.
Exactly. And that was, I think, the first deferred prosecution agreement, correct?
I think it was one of the first. Yeah. I mean, there may have been one used previously in connection with to Bristol-Myers Squibb. But okay. I think it was the first one against a healthcare system.
It was certainly the first one against a state healthcare system, because that's the state system. Chris Christie was U.S. attorney at the time. So it was definitely the first one.
Case.
You know, what's interesting is that, you know, we talk when we do our podcasts, you know, we try to bring the relevance of cases, because, you know, one of my favorite phrases is the circus never changes. It's just the clowns under the tent. And there's a lot of truth to that. And we talk about that, you know, Jason, Matt, Wade, and I on our weekly podcast, we talk often about the fact that, you know, one need not look much beyond a press release to learn about what to do. And we talk about this in our podcasts. We do it when we do our SIU training. We talk about intelligence gathering. And the easiest way to do intelligence gathering is look at historically what people have done. Look at the cases that are being prosecuted today, the civil settlements that are going on today involving things like genetic testing, the DME scams that have continued to go on, the $2 billion case involving the seven companies involved in the catheter schemes, the urine drug testing schemes, the kickbacks, all of that. None of that's different to us. We're still disgusted when we see that it's still going on, and we still think there are weaknesses in the program that can help to facilitate that. But it should never come as a shock to anybody when you see these cases involving hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud being perpetuated over very short periods of time. We talk about that constantly in the podcast about how, you know, if you're in the SIU space, if you're an analyst or an intelligence person, the simplest thing to do is troll the press releases for your local prosecutions, and you'll get all the information that you need to open up a bevy of cases that you may think that you didn't have time for.
But you always need the auditors. So the data is good, all of it is good, but then you need the auditors. And when I think of one of the absolute leaders in our space, I always think of Sunil, because she gives out such great information on her podcast. Sunil, how many episodes, how long have you been doing the podcast? Tell us all about it, because I think of you every time I think of coding greatness, auditing greatness, you're immediately who I go to. And I think that these cases, although they might be good, without the expertise of you, your team, people like you, none of this would really happen, because it's the receipts.
Well, thank you so much. You know what? I've been doing Paint the Medical Picture podcast for 4 years. It is over 200 episodes. So I just really like to participate, broaden my reach, especially in SIU audits and stuff like that, fraud, waste, and abuse space. So hopefully I have an audience that can support what it is that all of us are trying to do in this industry. So yeah, absolutely. You know, the OIG roundtable is something to look towards. You know, from their inside skinny, they have their pulse literally on the goings on of not only what is happening in those press releases, which I like to use, but they really talk to their colleagues, to their, you know, friends who are still hard at work in all of those spaces. So, you know, from week to week, they always have something new. If it's some sort of a DME fraud scheme, if it's injections or the catheters or those ambulances, you know, everything is hot and fresh. And so the coding professionals at large, I definitely think should be looking at these types of folks as well to try and prevent these types of instances of misuse. Yeah.
I listened to Matt. I feel lucky enough to bring Matt out to clients with me. Whether Matt really loves it or not, I do the dog and pony with Matt constantly. He loves it. We're good travelers together, like on the trains at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, that kind of travel. I listened to Matt always talk about, like, absolute excellence when it comes to the way to do the job. You know, there's nothing where we could take a shortcut and go through and just get to, like, okay, this is quick and dirty, just write it to the KFI, whatever. I always listen to Matt talk about these basic items that he makes it sound like, oh, okay, like everybody could do it. But really, you know, Matt, I always think about it as like the excellence of healthcare fraud, but you make it so simple at the same time. And that's something I really look up to when I think about, you know, being an outsider.
If you break down the job, it is pretty simple in its structure. It's you have to answer two questions. What were they doing, and did it violate the rules or laws? And, you know, the complexity is you have to then figure out what they were doing by taking the proper investigative steps, you know, whether it's interviews, the reviews, the audits, the on-sites, and then know how the rules that are in place apply to the actions. And so that is the essence of a healthcare fraud investigation. What were the rules in place and were they violating them? Now, the excellence comes in just out of a sense of fear. It's everything you do and everything you write is going to, at some point, eventually come into question, whether that be by a provider appealing an overpayment to being cross-examined on the witness stand. So to make sure that you are in the right, space and that you're not going to be caught off guard, you have to make sure that everything you do is done the right way according to the processes that you've put in place, so that there is, going back to some of the original comments, the consistency is there on the approach. Every case is different, absolutely. How those steps are taken should be the same every time.
I like that very much, Matt. And I feel that when I listen to, because again, I look at your faces, I know you're all really good. When I listen to people tell me like why they got into the job, whether it's at the OIG or whatever, I hear different reasoning. I find it very interesting that Jason has told me how he would make it interesting for his agents. So Jason, can you speak to that just a little bit? Because I think that was so unique for you to just have this foresight for how do I get these people engaged? How do they really want to do the job if you don't have like a type A just every single day? I find that interesting. Talk about your leadership philosophy there, please.
I think it has to do with respect. And I've been listening to some of the really nice commentary on this. And thank you all very much for that, because this has been a great group, and I've been happy and proud, frankly, to be able to participate in a great number of the podcasts. But it really comes down to that I have learned much more from this group and then the others that are not here than I have taught them. They don't maybe think it. Some of the, you know, commentary is, you know, it's very glowing and it's great. But the reality is, I'm a kid from Staten Island. You grew up on a 40-by-100 lot, you know, went to, you know, school and worked hard. But the reality was, you know, this was a big step for me. And, you know, whatever success I enjoyed was a result of getting the other people that I had to work with engaged. So, I mean, I joke all the time, like Eric has said so many glowing things at different venues and whatnot. And I think I have no idea, because Eric has zero tolerance for someone that's not pulling their weight. And am I lying, Eric? I mean, it's no. Anyway, so the reality was I'm more in awe of the fact that he thinks highly of me. And that, so again, it really just comes down to that. This is a two-way street. And to coin a phrase that's out there, which I think is very relevant here, is it takes a village. So to Eric's point about data lies, yeah, data lies, people lie, like, there's a lot of lies. It's our job is to cull through those lies and figure out what is the truth to beyond reasonable doubt or preponderance of the evidence that you can gather. And that's hard to do. If this was easy, there'd be a lot more people doing this than what we're talking about here. It's really hard to put people at risk where they're going to lose their livelihood, they're going to lose their job, they're going to lose their freedom, any of those things. So bottom line is, you know, my theory about getting the others engaged is to show them, and I'm hoping that they've seen that over the years, is that I have just as much interest in their success as they have interest in their own success. And that, to me, is the single most motivating factor.
Also, I'll just jump in with one thing. I think, Jason, from the mentoring experience that I had with you, you jumped into the work with us. You know, it wasn't like you, as the supervisor told us, you know, go do A, B, and C. Like, you were doing it with us. And I remember many, many times, you know, in situations where you made suggestions at meetings and, you know, progressing the case or developing the case in a certain direction that I would not have thought of on my own had you not been there. So I just really want to call that out. And, you know, on a case that we had in Brooklyn where, you know, the mailbox drop case, and we were doing surveillance on Saturdays and Sundays just to try to move the case along. And, you know, I just want to say I appreciate those moments, because not a lot of supervisors would do that, you know, really get, you know, knee deep in the work, you know, and be there as a leader and a support. So
when you say knee deep, do you really mean from the passenger seat of the car with the car reclined?
I was going to say that too, actually. Yes, you know, that
Light comes snores up every now and then, right?
Yes, I mean, yeah, that came happens. With the position, you know, you earned right. The right to sit in the passenger seat and snore while we were going through the Holland Tunnel. I mean, that's just...
Hey, if the shoe fits, wear it. Okay, so Susan is brand new to the job. Susan and I are sitting in a diner while we were getting some work done on a car, a new siren or something like that. And I'm giving Susan a little overview of the job. And she said, and it was just said so innocently, I don't know if you remember this, but you said so innocently, so then this is a good job to have. And it's like it took me 9 years to get into the 1811 position. Now, you know, anyway, Eric, right? You patrolled the wall of Allenwood. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, but maybe greatness reveals itself sooner with certain people like Susan. Omar, I mean, so we were tasked with reopening office in Puerto Rico. Omar put his whole life on the line to transfer down there to do it. And if it wasn't for Omar, I wouldn't have learned how good mofongo tastes on a particular day and where to get the best Puerto Rican food. But in all seriousness, like, Omar, he acted in the capacity as a as an assistant special agent in charge when, you know, he wasn't that. I mean, that office became a shining star of the Caribbean and of the New York region. So, you know, I would have a million of these stories, but, you know, the bottom line is the public is well served by the mission that OIG has. And the fact is that these podcasts, I think, help illuminate that because, you know, when you're still connected to the service, the problem is anything you say most likely, you know, will be repeated in some venue, as Matt said. You know, you're gonna be challenged on what it is that you do. So, you know, I think, frankly, you know, the podcast can bridge that gap of, you know, OI not being in a position really to talk about some of the ins and outs of what happens behind the scenes, and we can, you know, and I think that's been, you know, enlightening to me.
Thank you, Jason. Your point also about making a difference is really important because, you know, one of the things is people think about HHS, OIG, and, you know, looking at, you know, and fraud, waste, and abuse as, you know, overbilling Medicare, overbilling Medicaid. But, you know, it's a whole lot more than that. And, you know, when I was thinking about this 2 years ago, when Eric and I spoke at the Healthcare Compliance Association, one of the things that we brought up was, you know, kind of as reported as kind of, you know, kind of the same thing, you know, 25 years, you know, people doing the same thing. There was some, we reported at the time at some ENT, Anita Louise Jackson in Lumberton, North Carolina, which is has a population of 18,000. And she had billed more for a particular sinus procedure than anybody in the United States. And I mean, we reported, and that was kind of, there's the numbers, the data mining and that kind of thing. But, you know, last year she was finally, she went to trial. And one of the things that she, I mean, what started was the overbilling. But what was ultimately uncovered was that she did more than 1,400 sinus surgeries, but only bought 36 of the single-use medical devices to do the sinus surgeries. So there was an incredible infection issue. I mean, and this is more than just money. And so something that started as overbilling, you know, really, I mean, in terms of the wrongdoers and peeling off the onion, you know, the wrongdoing was a whole lot deeper. But in terms of making a difference, you know, there at least, you know, and, you know, you got somebody ultimately, you know, out of an office who was potentially killing people. She was sentenced to 25 years and was immediately taken into custody after the jury verdict. But she is appealing.
When you talk about this kind of thing, Lisa, I think it's so important for people who are brand new in their career. So I look to Julie Smallwood, who just joined us. She's actually on our team. She's newer to this, all the way up to Jim Cox, who has, thank you for joining us, Jim, who has been around and doing a tremendous job for us in so many capacities, that both in terms of his career in New York, and, you know, Jason brought Jim to us, so I'm going to have you both talk in a second. But when you think about the entire range of what we do for healthcare, I look at all of your faces, and I know each one of you cares about the cost of healthcare. Each one of you cares about the delivery of and truly the quality of care. And it's interesting to me how the same type of people who have their heart in the right spot gravitate toward each other. There's a lot of people in our industry, but there's only a couple of you. And I very much appreciate being able to know you and collaborate with you. Lisa, you mentioned exactly what's important. It's like, are you killing patients? Are you helping people? Like, isn't that what healthcare really is about? So, Jim, thank you for being here. We really appreciate it. I think you know a number of people on this call, Jim.
Yes, thank you so much for the invite. I'm really excited to be part of this 100th OIG roundtable discussion. I got goosebumps on my arms. I'm so excited to be listening to some of these stories and seeing some of these faces. Lisa just made this excellent point, right? That, oh yeah, it's about money and it's about putting people in jail. But for me, always in the back of my mind was, well, what about patient care? What does it do to the patients? And I can remember, back in 97-ish, we did a data analysis of nursing home patients. The number one biller of orthotics in New York State and the number two biller in New Jersey was a company based out of Palm Harbor, Florida. And I remember the name of the individual that ran the company. He was a graduate of Hamilton School. It's a nice college in upstate New York. And what for each patient that he was billing somewhere between 15 and 25 different orthotics for these patients, right? So I was working with a fellow, John Burback, at the time. And all we kept envisioning is these poor patients. I mean, from head to toe, they had orthotics strapped to them one way or the other, right? And we just kept envisioning that these poor patients are like, you know, just strung out on a bed. They can't move a finger because, you know, they got something strapped to it. So we started to, do our own investigations and audit. And it turns out, you know, totally misrepresenting the billings. He actually had wheelchairs that had like a neck brace in the back that, you know, that had a footrest for the patient and an armrest. And he's billing tens and tens of thousands of dollars for these patients when he's providing, you know, at the most a $1,500 wheelchair for these people. And, just that patient care and what was going on to patients, when Lisa told that story, immediately that came into mind. And just over the years, had so many great people. I mean, you know, I see these faces in front of me. Susan and I still need to get together and have that coffee. In your honor, Jean Marie, I have some meatballs back here because you keep promising me meatballs. And I can't get them from you. Your mom, I don't know, I think she hides them or something. I'm not really sure. But I have my daughter make them. And, you know, so I thought, well, I'll sit here and I wish this was wine too, but it's not. So the next best thing for me is a glass of milk. But anyways, you know, just some absolutely great times with people. And still to this day, you know, when you hear about what OIG and OI in particular is doing, I mean, it's very exciting. Down in Florida, North Carolina, you know, it's just incredible what's going on. And Jason mentioned Puerto Rico, had fabulous trips down there. And you guys just lost a good agent down there, Alexei. He just left and went over to Postal Service, which I was very sad to hear about. But, you know, just some great times. And so, I don't know, just so glad that I had the opportunity to work for the federal government and, you know, be part of HHS. So thank you for inviting me. I hope to be here for the 1,000th episode.
Oh, that's so sweet. I hope so, too. Julie? I didn't know if Julie was saying something. I hope so, too. Thank you, Jim. I love that idea. You know, I think when we got started, nobody really thought, like, is this going to last? Is this going to be good? But there's just so many great people that we collaborate with every single day. I look and I see some of my full-time folks here. But then partners, I see other people. Julie Janeway is a part of Advise. Julie Janeway, the great Julie Janeway, who looks fabulous. Julie, like commercial in our t-shirt. Please, I know that you in particular are somebody who could be up late at night on the phone battling for the good of healthcare, and that's something that is very hard to find in people because you've been doing it for a while. It's not like you're brand new to it and you're excited. You've seen all the ills of healthcare. You're still going after and doing it. Thank you for being part of this community.
you. Well, if I can have a second, I want to congratulate all you guys on not only your 100th episode, but on a lifetime of exactly what Jean Marie is talking about. You know, a whole career of fighting the good fight. And even when you retired from your government positions and other such positions, you stayed in the fight. And you know what, Jean Marie, this is a whole group of people that, you know, is like me, that have made a career and a lifetime out of the fight. And, you know, as Jim, as you were talking about, you know, it really comes down to the patients. And that's ultimately what we fight for. We fight for the healthcare, the welfare, the safety of the patients, the financial safety of the patients. You know, like they can get better care and more care if you know, everybody has to pay less, right? And it's we also fight for the employees, right? We fight for the healthcare providers, the other employees, the administrators. You can't hire as many risk management people or compliance people or clinicians or whatever it is if you are constantly having to, you know, hike up the prices, and then less people can get that healthcare. So it's a big cycle. And I think those of us at Advise and in many other places, I do this all over the world now, this is something that you constantly have to keep the big picture in mind. So where the OIG roundtable quite often will take a very specific, very pinpointed subject and examine it, it's always part of the larger picture. And at Advise and many other, like I said, similarly, principled company, shall we say, people who have their eye on the bigger picture, then I have to say that, you know, that's where the best good is done. That's where we see those warriors, right? Those welfare warriors. And I don't mean welfare as in welfare check. I mean the welfare of people. And so congratulations to all of you guys for your commitment and for your bravery throughout the years, and for your willingness to continue the good fight.
Thank you, Julie. I feel like oftentimes, and this happens every single day, we just work and work and work, and we don't really take a pause to say, you know what, that was pretty good. We did something. I know this is a different format for a podcast, having different people come in and out, and just a little bit more of a fun, like not necessarily a topic, more so like a thank you. I love what you said, Julie. More so of a thank you for everything you've done. And hey, here's to the next 100 episodes. Here's what we want to talk about. Here's what we want to see. I think it would be great to have an episode on some international stuff. I would love to hear more about that, Julie. I think that would be wonderful coming up. I look to my FTEs, I look to my full-time folks here. So I see Carrie, I see David and Julie. I think this is a great representation of what it looks like for the collaborators with our OIG folks, right? So, and I look at Carrie, for instance, phenomenal background. Carrie, I'd like for you to just speak for a moment about like where you come from, because I think it's a, like when I think about almost like braiding a hair, like if you think about like a perfect braid where everything comes together, it's just amazing. It looks wonderful. That's how I think of you, because you know the coach, you know the investigation, you know all of it. So tell us all about your fabulousness, please.
I started at Noridian. I spent over 20 years largely in fraud, waste, and abuse. Saw up close and personal 1-800-HHS tips almost, well, thank God it wasn't every week. They from across the country, so you got to know who the players were consistently, regardless the demographic. Supported the UPICs, what is now the UPICs as well, for during that entire time, was providing subject matter information to both law enforcement, prosecutors, and anyone else, and worked closely with CMS as well. So got my feet wet there, spent that time, took a couple years off, and then spent a couple time at both UPICs, or very short, and then I'm here now on a contract, enjoying it and seeing it all over again, the same things, just a different place. Having prior knowledge of this jurisdiction has been very, very useful.
It never seems to go away, does it? It's the same stuff over and over.
I love how both of you ladies, actually, Julie and Carrie, when I talk to you about things that are happening with our team, with like newer investigators, with newer CPCs, both of you have this way of looking forward and you, again, stay engaged in it and feel excited. I think so many people would just be over it, like, wait a second, this is happening all over again. But I've talked to you about like your leadership of thinking through the teams and being excited about it. That's something I have to say I really applaud and I'm very appreciative of it.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. But we appreciate your forward-looking perspective at all times, too. And I, you know how I get over? It's the same thing over and over again. You know, it's like you have to pause and give creativity points. So, Jim, you were just telling that story about the orthotics, like strapped to every square inch. I was sitting here kind of laughing, going, hey, I got to give this guy creativity points. So when you see the same scam, you know, for 30 years in a row, you just sometimes you're just like, okay, all right, you're still a scummy criminal, but that's okay. You're a creative scummy criminal.
How about the energy that Jean Marie brings to the organization?
Thank you. That's
it's amazing. Always about to oh remembering the legacy that you all have put forth that I think we all have had impressed upon us. And to provide it forward, that's just part of it. I think that's what this group is about.
Thank you. I feel really honored to work with you and learn from all of you. I really feel honored. I'm excited when I see people like Julie Smallwood coming in and starting her career off with such a tremendous group of individuals. I look to you, Carrie and David, as great mentors. If I was Julie, I'd be on the phone with you every single day. Like, just tell me what you're having for lunch. David, you are the quintessential. Like, can you believe this provider did that? Thank you for joining us. Tell us about your background a little bit and also the OIG roundtable. If there's anything you want to roast the guys on, if there's anything you want to tell us what you want in the next 100 episodes, we want to hear.
Oh, these are amazing individuals, and I really appreciate being involved in this. So, I mean, 100 episodes, I mean, 100 more, 500 more, 1,000 more. You guys will be doing this forever. So just think about that. So my background, I'm coming from behavioral health. I started off actually in direct care. Prior to that, I was in the Army, but I kind of fell into behavioral health, and compliance, working with individuals with disabilities, working in group homes and day programs, and then kind of worked my way into the compliance world. So, you know, I have a unique appreciation for individuals in that particular space, the vulnerable kind of population that we see all over the place in our profession. So it is very, like DeMarie is saying, like I see it all. And like Julie was saying, you see those creativity points when you see certain things in the notes and in the documentation, the records. So, you know, I've done the direct care, I've done the compliance, I've worked for the state of Arizona, I've worked for providers, you know, I've been an educator, a contractor, and everything in between. So I've, you know, been around the block, I feel like, and I don't feel that old, but, you know, I really do appreciate all of this.
You and I, you know, we're well-preserved.
Not all this, yeah. each one is a provider. I very much appreciate just everything that Advise really stands for, and I know that the big push right now is that education piece, the communication piece, making sure everybody is involved and making sure that not only the members are getting the help that they need and the services they need, but also the providers are understanding what they're doing and why they're doing it. So, you know, I think there's always been a little bit of a disconnect between, you know, billing and compliance and like, you know, just this whole world, like nobody really seems to kind of really know how to mesh those two things together. And I think Advise is really trying to do a great job with kind of merging those two worlds together and really trying to get people to understand, like, this is a comprehensive thing. It's not one or the other. It's not, you know, clinicians versus billers and coders and compliance people. Everybody needs to be working together. And I really do appreciate that about this organization and all you guys. So,
you know, one of the things that I think is kind of a fun thing to talk about is when we put these podcasts together every week, it's not scripted. You know, while what I typically do is we'll find a hot topic, and then Matt and Jason and Wade and I will kind of go back and forth for a few minutes about that topic and kind of figure out how we're going to talk about it for 20 minutes or a half an hour, kind of just give that important content. And a piece of that puzzle, which a lot of people don't realize, is when I talk to Carrie and she's talking about a settlement, those things factor in to our discussions. When I talk to Julie, who, you know, Julie is a compliance expert, like it really is her wheelhouse. And when we work on projects where Julie is leading the charge on creating an effective compliance program or something, and we have calls with the clients on this, and we're doing a lot of work now with lawyers who are deferring to us and to Julie for that expertise. And once I get those calls going, I really do like to sit and just listen to Julie tell her story about the things in compliance, because it really does lend itself to when we have conversations with clients or potential clients from it, or, you know, we're talking about the deliverable on an audit that we did, and I get David's opinion of it, because he'll look at it and he'll say, no, this is wrong for this reason. It becomes the topic of a podcast. And then I think in terms of the Julie Smallwood people, because Julie came with very little experience as a new investigator, you know, kind of in a smaller Medicaid unit where she gets to learn and grow with the job. And so when I'm thinking of our podcasts, and Matt and Wade and Jason and I are kind of brainstorming, to a large extent, we're really thinking about the Julie Smallwood people and the Jesse Siegel people who, you know, Julie came with very, very little in the healthcare kind of fraud, waste, abuse world, whereas Jesse came with a ton of fraud, waste, abuse experience, but not SIU, right? Because she's doing audits and coding. And so when we're putting together a lot of these podcasts, oftentimes our topics of conversation and our thought process are talking to the Julie Smallwoods of the world, because the way that Julie is going to be a better advised investigator and the way that she's going to grow is, you know, free training and education, right? Answering the questions that people are sometimes shy to ask or may not even think to ask because they've never experienced it. And so it becomes an interesting piece for us when we're coming up with talking about a topic, is making it legible for people, right? When we use the vernacular, we try to say, okay, we're not talking about a CIA. This is a corporate integrity agreement. And then kind of working through that discussion, because not everybody is a 20, 30-year seasoned, you know, healthcare fraud, waste, abuse person. Sometimes it's someone who's never, ever heard the phrase medic or UPIC or payment integrity. So a lot of it works towards making the Julie Smallwoods, the future of healthcare fraud investigations, more confident in their ability to hold those conversations at a younger point. It's almost like we're trying to mentor people, and I don't want it to seem like with hubris or arrogance, but it's almost like we want to be able to get people to understand the things that, you know, we've understood for 30 years.
Eric, this is Jim. My quick question for you and the group. Do you think there's a role for us or an obligation for us to help OIG, OI recruit people?
It's a good question. What I think the challenge is that the SIU space, from the non-government side, the SIU space right now is in a little bit of turmoil. There's a lot of layoffs of SIU people and payment integrity people. And then the problem is, to an extent, COVID has ruined the industry from the work from home perspective, and that people are demanding salaries that are just not commensurate with the market. You know, we were just doing some hiring, and some of the salaries that people were asking for, you want to hit yourself over the head with a hammer. Like, how could you even ask that? But there is a fine line, because the difference is that in the government space, you know, there may be one position and there's going to be 500 applicants. And so part of it is, you know, are we to be a feeder for the government, or vice versa? Is the government a feeder for us? I think that there's a symbiotic relationship that we as OIG alumni have with OIG that is very different than a lot of other instances. You know, people go and work at the SIU of a commercial payer, and there's very little allegiance, right? It's all about where you're going to go to get some better benefit or what have you. And I think, you know, when Matt and Wade and Jason and I, and, you know, you talk to April, there's a little bit of that esprit de corps that we have. You know, we were proud about where we worked and happy that we did it, and it gave us a good career. And I think that there's that symbiotic relationship. I talk to the OIG people all the time about, you know, how they could do better at things that they do, because we see it from the outside now looking in. You know, I can't tell you how many cases I've worked on where OIG was my adversary. And, you know, there are times where I've beaten OIG up on cases where it was appropriate. You can't look to go and indict somebody on $1 million when the fraud's $125,000. You didn't do a good investigation, and here's why. You have to be an advocate on both sides. But I think that symbiotic relationship that we all continue to have with the OIG, the FBI, the VA, all those organizations, it certainly helps us with understanding where the tenor of those people are. But it certainly helps when, you know, I got contacted by somebody on LinkedIn the other day who's interested in a career at the OIG, and she just doesn't know enough about it. She's in law school. She's got a master's in healthcare policy. She really wants to get into the healthcare law enforcement piece and just doesn't understand enough about it. And so I think that for us, that's part of that metric, is being able to say to somebody like, hey, maybe working at the OIG, maybe it's not about the badge and gun. Maybe it is working at Office of Audit Services or Office of Evaluation and Inspection. Maybe it is something where you want to do that piece of the puzzle, being an analyst for OIG or some other organization where, you know, you can educate people about other roles that exist in the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse space that don't require a badge and a gun, because there's lots of those jobs. And there's lots of people out there who have an interest in it but don't want to be a badge and a gun carrier. I mean, I look at Julie is a great example. Julie Janeway is a great example. She's the non-prosecutor prosecutor, because when you talk to Julie about things from that fraud, waste, abuse compliance perspective, she'll be the first one to tell you it's nonsense. And she'll say, well, I'm not a prosecutor, but man, that doesn't fit right. And here's the problem, and here's this, and here's that. So there's that. There's a lot of that crossover that exists. And I think to kind of, you know, be normally long-winded, everybody listens to the first 45 minutes of my 10-minute long story. Jim, there is a lot of the truth really is that symbioticness and that crossover is what becomes that important piece of the puzzle. And, you know, maybe there is somebody out there who's getting a degree in criminal justice, healthcare administration, accounting, and doesn't want to be a public accountant, doesn't want to be a badge carrying person, but there are a lot of supportive roles within the OIG community, and not just HHS. You've got VA, OPM, Postal, DCIS, all these organizations where you could lend that, you know, that level of knowledge towards these other collateral pieces of the puzzle that are just as important.
Can I add a little bit on that? I like this question, Jim, because, you know, there's two ways to be a feeder, and Eric has touched on it. One is direct referrals, and the other one is educating their current workforce. And this is something that I do all the time, because OIG does a great job, really. I mean, it's a hard job. There's no two ways about it. DOJ, it's a hard job. You've got all this politics and power play garbage going on in the background that they have to deal with. But they do need to be educated, and we need to hold their feet to the fire. And the reason I say that is it's the same theory as defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys. So criminal defense attorneys, people say, how could you, you know, do that? I've done very, very little criminal defense. I'm always on the other side. But I've done a lot of defense, audit defense, and, you know, a lot of defense in other respects. But people always say, how can you be on that side? Because my job is not to get somebody who's committed an infraction of some sort and size. It's not to get them off scot-free. My job is to hold the system to account, okay? That's what I think the best thing that we can do as those of us who work out here in the private industry is to hold the system to account. And because the government is part of the system, the way the courts are part of the system, that's our job. That's our educational job. And as a law professor for 30 years, I train the new ones, the new lawyers, and all of my colleagues all over the United States and the world. I train them. Here's the law. Here are the fine points, the exceptions to the exceptions to the exceptions. You can't do four or five. You have to do all five. It's an all or nothing situation. And that's, I think, our role in feeding for the government, because although the politics turns over, the administrations don't. But what they will take out are those people with institutional memory and the people who've seen it, you know, evolve and devolve and revolve and everything else. And I think it's you, the type, you know, well, all of us really in all of our types of roles, who are the people who have to be an external institutional memory for them and say, yeah, 20 years ago, they tried this and it went down in flames. Go have your OIG or go have your DOJ lawyer do research and pull the cases up. And then you'll see why you couldn't and shouldn't have done that. And I think that it's really important. And as to other roles, yes, come see me. If anybody asks you, especially law students or, you know, people in healthcare administration, I can tell them 500 different jobs that they can do that they will have what I always call God's work, right? Feel good work. I'm working for the patients. I'm making things better. You know, I do the right thing. I can sleep at night. There's just a ton of those jobs out there. And it is up to those of us who really take it seriously to encourage others to move into those jobs. Good things like David did, moving into mental health and things like that.
Such a beautiful way to end this party. So I will say I love those words, Julie, and I appreciate the great question, Jim. I like everybody wearing the t-shirt for advice. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for all of your great work. Each one of you have made healthcare better, and I really do. I thank you as a patient. I thank you as a person at advice. Thank you for all that you do. Very excited to continue to work with you. Looking forward to the next 100 episodes, everybody. Woot woot. Thank you so much for being here. I'd like to keep Julie Smallwood, Eric, Matt, and Wade on the call with Carrie and David, please. Thank you, everybody, so much for being here. Really appreciate this a lot. I so appreciate. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Awesome. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining the 100th episode of the OIG Roundtable. And as always, you can catch our newsletter every Friday in your inbox. Just send us an email, info@advisehealth.com, or go up to our website, newly designed, refreshed, and sign up for the newsletter right there. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.